This is Talk is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. All right, this week, U of O Professor David Lebke introduces Professor Omer Bartov. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
Recorded live at the U of O mid-April.
It's a personal honor for me, simply because I've been a fan of his scholarship since the 1990s, and have been assigning his books to my students for over two decades, pretty much the whole time I've been here. If you're not an academic, chances are that the first time you've heard of Professor Bartov is in the immediate aftermath of the massacres of October 7, 2023, when he published an essay in the New York Times warning of the danger that of the then developing Gaza war could turn into a genocide. By the summer of 2025, he'd become convinced that that conflict had indeed become genocidal, and said so in another widely read editorial, also in the New York Times. Historians like me and Jeff and Julie have known about Professor Bartov for a good deal longer than that. He belongs to the first generation of Israelis to have been born and raised in the state of Israel, a fact about his biography that has quite a lot of bearing on what we'll hear tonight. His career as a scholar has unfolded in two main phases. In the first phase, he wrote about soldiers in the German army during World War II, specifically how they transformed into instruments of ideological warfare, fighting to the bitter end, all that stuff. One product of that scholarship was a book called Hitler's Army, published in 1992, and that's the one I've been assigning all these years. I recommend it very highly. The second phase began in the late 90s and early aughts and involved a turn to the history of the Holocaust, not at all the same thing, collective memory as well as collective forgetting. Like the first phase, this one has generated many books and many articles, most prominently Anatomy of Genocide, The Life and Death of a Town Called Bucha, published in 2018. It's a micro-history of his mother's hometown, and I recommend it very highly, too. Professor Bartov is a historian for whom the salience of scholarship is ever-present. The title of his talk this evening is Israel, What Went Wrong? Please join me in welcoming Professor Bartov.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I will try to introduce you today my forthcoming book. It's coming out on the 21st of this month, which is titled, as the title of this lecture, Israel, What Went Wrong? Is this better?
It's pretty good. Yeah.
So I'll just repeat, I will try to introduce today my forthcoming book, which is actually coming out on the 21st of this month, so very soon, and it's titled, as is this lecture, Israel, What Went Wrong? This book explores the tragic transformation, as I see it, of Zionism, a movement that sought to emancipate European Jewry from oppression and persecution into a state ideology of ethno-nationalism and increasingly focused on the exclusion and violent domination of Palestinians under Israeli rule. The book asks, how is it possible that the state founded in the immediate aftermath of the Holocaust stands today credibly accused of war crimes, forcible displacement of civilian populations, and crimes against humanity? By what bitter irony, by what bitter cunning of history have we come to the point that not even 8 decades after the Jewish state was established in 1948, the same year in which the Genocide Convention was adopted by the United Nations, Israel engaged in 2 years of genocidal undertaking with impunity from the very international legal regime set up after World War II to prevent and punish this crime. And how do we come to terms with the fact that Israel's war of destruction was conducted with the wide support, laced with denial and indifference, of most of its Jewish citizens? So the book traces the roots and realities of the violent events that unfolded in Israel and the occupied territories since October 7th, 2023. And the final pages of the book, and I'll talk a little bit about it also when I come to the closing part of this talk, I try to sketch out future scenarios at a time of great uncertainty and confusion. Some would argue that what we watched with shock and horror was the inevitable consequence of Zionist settler colonialism set in motion in the late 19th century. And in part, that is true. But the focus on the functional reality of settlement in Palestine, to my opinion, largely misses the ideological and emotional motivations of this movement, as well as the underlying self-perception of generations of Zionist activists and supporters. What interests me, and what makes the history leading to this moment all the more tragic, is that the unfolding events can be seen as inevitable only in retrospect. So I ask, was this an unavoidable development, or was it the product of particular circumstances and decisions? Was there a crucial moment at which things began turning in one direction rather than the other? Can the grim logic of events be reversed? Or are we observing an unstoppable rush by Israel toward the destruction of others, as well as self-annihilation as a society and state proclaiming democratic and liberal values? So as you can imagine, these questions have kept me up at night since the Hamas attack on southern Israel, in which some 800 civilians were massacred and 251 taken hostage. This event was swiftly followed by a fierce Israeli military campaign of utter annihilation against the Gaza Strip as a whole, in which 72,000 Palestinians were killed, about 80% of them civilians, the majority of them children. At least 10,000 are missing, likely buried under the rubble. And untold thousands of babies, chronically ill persons, and others in need of medical care have become indirect victims of the destruction of Gaza's medical services, deliberate destruction. But my concern with the larger context of Israel's identity and relationship to the Palestinians is not recent. In a certain sense, as I've come to realize, it has been part of my own making since I can remember myself. So I'll tell you a few things about myself. I was born and raised in Israel. A member, as was mentioned, of the first generation that came into the world following the state's creation. Less typically, my father was also born in what was then Mandatory Palestine, shortly after his parents arrived there from Poland in the mid-1920s. My paternal grandfather, who grew up in dire poverty, was exposed to local anti-Semitism and was a staunch Zionist. My father had to leave school and seek employment at the age of 15 to help support the household. 2 years later, he volunteered to join the Jewish Brigade of the British Army and to fight in World War II. He too was a Zionist throughout his life. His encounter with the survivors of the Holocaust when he was in uniform in Europe remained etched on his soul and found expression in several of the novels he subsequently wrote. My mother, who was born in Poland, came to Palestine with her parents and two brothers at the age of 11 in 1935. Her father, too, was a staunch Zionist and an observant Jew. The family was plunged into poverty upon arrival in the Promised Land. But no one ever complained about my grandfather's choice to leave Poland, which was growing increasingly unstable, poor, and anti-Semitic. I was born in Israel thanks to my grandfather's decision to leave the land where my family had lived for centuries. Had he stayed, I would have likely not been born at all. As I grew up, I realized that although all families are different, most of those I knew in Israel had one thing in common. They had lost virtually all their relatives who stayed behind in Europe. I was lucky to have two sets of grandparents, but my father's and my mother's extended families in Poland were all murdered. We lived in mutilated families, and the sense of loss and mourning was ubiquitous, though rarely articulated. Told that we were the first generation of our people's resurrection, we never questioned our presence, existence, and future in Israel. Yet over time, even as the visible signs of the destruction of Palestinian culture all around us were gradually demolished and covered over, some of us became increasingly aware that our resurrection had come at the price of another people's catastrophe. I grew up in Tel Aviv, in neighborhoods built right next to or over the remnants of Palestinian villages whose residents had fled Israeli troops. I served in the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, for 4 years, a term that included the 1973 Yom Kippur War and postings in the West Bank, Northern Sinai, and Gaza, where I saw firsthand poverty and hopelessness of Palestinian refugees eking out a living in congested, decrepit neighborhoods. I should say that at the time the population of Gaza was about 350,000, and of course now it's over 2 million, and now Palestinians live in half of the Gaza Strip. Other half is occupied by the IDF. I remember patrolling the shadeless, silent streets of the Egyptian town of Al Arish, which was then occupied by Israel, pierced by the gazes of the fearful, resentful population observing us from their shuttered windows. For the first time, I understood what it meant to occupy another people. I wrote my PhD thesis, later published as a book, and this was mentioned, of course, in the introduction, thank you, on the Nazi indoctrination of the German army and the crimes it perpetrated on the Eastern Front in World War II. What I found in my research ran counter to the way Germans in the 1980s understood their past. Germans preferred to think that the army had fought a so-called decent war, anständiger Krieg, even as the Gestapo and the SS perpetrated genocide behind its back. It took Germans many more years to realize just how complicit their own fathers and grandfathers had been in the Holocaust and the mass murder of many other groups in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. When the first Intifada, or uprising, broke out in late 1987, I was teaching at Tel Aviv University. I was appalled by Minister of Defense Yitzhak Rabin's instruction to the IDF to, quote, break the arms and legs of Palestinian youths who were throwing rocks at heavily armed IDF troops. I wrote a letter to Rabin, quite cheekily, warning that based on my research on the indoctrination of the armed forces of Nazi Germany, I feared that under his leadership, the IDF was heading down a similarly slippery slope. And to my astonishment, a few days later, I received a one-line response from him, chiding me for daring to compare the IDF with the German military. In retrospect, I believe this exchange revealed something about his subsequent intellectual journey. For as we know from his later engagement in the Oslo Peace Accord, however flawed, he did eventually recognize that in the long run, Israel could not sustain the military, political, and moral price of the occupation. Now, since 1989, I've been teaching in the United States. I spent many years researching, again, it was mentioned here, the transformation of my mother's hometown, Buchach, in Poland, now in Ukraine, from a community of inter-ethnic coexistence between Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews, into one in which, under the Nazi occupation, the Gentile population turned against the Jewish neighbors. In the months since October 7th, what I had learned over the course of my life and my career became more painfully relevant than ever before. Like many others, I found this to be an emotionally and intellectually challenging period. Like many others, I saw members of my own and my friends' families directly affected by the violence. There is no dearth of grief wherever you turn. I've always maintained close links with Israel. My parents are buried in the kibbutz of my birth, and my eldest son lives in Tel Aviv with his family, as do most of my best friends. But I now feel increasingly estranged from Israel. It seems to be a different, strange, and threatening place, whose people, including some of my friends, have been transformed, perhaps irretrievably. It is a country trapped in its own sense of shock and trauma, in deep denial of the crimes being committed in its name by its people. Sorry, I'm just recovering from a cold, so. There is, of course, no understanding of Israel's current predicament without considering its past and the movement that led to a Jewish state. Zionism was the product of the vast transformation of Jewish life in the European diaspora that followed the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, and the rise of nationalism. Ironically, just as the Jews sort of metaphorically came out of the ghetto and joined the mainstream of European society, they found themselves increasingly associated with all the ills of modernity, urbanization, and the erosion of traditional society. It was under these circumstances that modern anti-Semitism was constituted as an ideology and a political platform for the mass mobilization of movements and parties. This led in turn to a Jewish quest to solve the emerging so-called Jewish question through a variety of political movements, one of which was Zionism. In his 1882 essay, Auto-Emancipation, the Russian Jewish physician, Leon Pinsker, described the Jews in the diaspora as a zombie nation. He wrote, "The uncanny form of one of the dead walking among the living, a ghost-like apparition of a living corpse, A people without unity or organization, without land or other bonds of unity, no longer alive and yet walking among the living, a spectral form without precedence in history. He wrote, this process culminated in Judeophobia, which was his name for anti-Semitism. Zionism then envisioned itself as the only possible answer to this abnormal, perverse condition. Of course, Zionism sought not only to liberate Jews from persecution, exclusion, and violence, but also to provide them with the same kind of national self-determination that their neighbors had accomplished. But for Zionists, national liberation could be implemented only outside the territories of mass Jewish habitation where they were increasingly unwanted. Instead, Zionism envisioned the Jews' religious, historical, and mythical ancestral land as the site where this newly declared Jewish nation would be resurrected. That intended resurrection took place in parallel with mounting persecution and eventual genocide. As the expanding Jewish community in Palestine began creating the infrastructure of a future state under the aegis of the British mandate, practicing the familiar processes of a settler colonial takeover of land and resources from the indigenous Palestinian population, millions of Jews who remained in Europe were first discriminated against and persecuted, and later murdered by the Nazis and their numerous European collaborators. In the aftermath of World War II and the Holocaust, an exhausted Britain sought to abandon its increasingly burdensome rule in Palestine, while the international community leaned more than ever towards supporting the creation of an independent Jewish state. The bitter war that ensued between the Jews and the Palestinians, who rejected the United Nations partition plan for Palestine as unfair and unjust, which it was, supported by the invasion of several Arab armies, ended up in a Jewish victory and a Palestinian catastrophe. Seeking to ensure a solid Jewish majority, Jewish forces during the fighting expelled most of the Palestinian population, which had previously constituted two-thirds of the country's inhabitants, from the territories that became the State of Israel. So these two traumatic events, the Holocaust and the Nakba, that's catastrophe in Arabic, the violent mass displacement of the Palestinians in 1948, are inextricably linked historically, personally, and as part of the politics of memory. And they have respectively become constitutive of Israeli and Palestinian national identities. The year of 1948, therefore, saw both the establishment of a Jewish state, perceived as the answer to the Holocaust, and the uprooting of Palestinian civilization in Palestine. On May 14, 1948, as the British mandate was about to expire, the Jewish People's Council in Palestine promulgated the declaration of the establishment of the State of Israel, which is popularly known in Israel as the Declaration of Independence. It's not exactly clear independence from what, because the British were already leaving of their own accord, but that's how it's known. Ironically, even as hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were being expelled, this document included a series of lofty assurances of equality and justice to all citizens of the state, regardless of ethnicity, creed, and gender. The declaration set a deadline of October 1st, 1948, for the constitution that will provide the legal framework for the state's institutions and the nature of the regime. But no constitution was ever adopted, and the legal status of the declaration remains disputed. As Israel evolved without a constitution reflecting the democratic and liberal principles of the Declaration of Independence, Zionism itself transformed from a movement for Jewish self-emancipation, individual transformation, self-determination, and freedom from persecution and anti-Semitism into a state ideology. Whereas before 1948, Zionism presented two faces, one of liberation from oppression and the other of settler colonialism and ethno-nationalism, once the state was established, it was the latter, ethno-nationalism, that came to dominate Israeli politics. Not unlike other political concepts and philosophies, such as socialism and fascism, that changed dramatically when they took over states, Zionism began to transform as soon as it became Israel's official ideology. Arguably, a constitution based on the progressive principles of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and these principles had to do with acceptance to the UN on the conditions set by the partition resolution, so they were also practical in that sense, but had such a constitution been adopted, that might have served to constrain the worst impulses of Zionism. It might have prevented, or at least at a minimum limited, the reach of the military rule imposed on Israel's Arab citizens between 1948 and 1966. The same 150,000 Palestinians who remained in Israel after 1948 and were promised equal rights, then immediately had military rule imposed on them for 20 years. It might have also facilitated the process of repatriation for part of the Palestinian population that fled or was expelled in 1948. Instead, as time went by, the focus of Zionism as state ideology determined that in the competition between being Jewish and being democratic, the state tilted increasingly toward the former. First, in the sense of being a state strictly for Jews, and then in becoming ever more and ever more Jewish state. This was a long process and never an inevitable one. One mechanism that came to play an important role in the transformation of Israel into what it has become by now was its politics of memory and commemoration. In the wake of World War II and the Holocaust, memorials went up everywhere, proclaiming commitment to never let such inhumanity happen again. But there was no universal consensus over what it was that would never be repeated. Since the Holocaust, as a historical event, was already over. There were those who pledged never to let genocide of any kind happen again. In Israel, however, the pledge was interpreted differently to mean never again any genocide of Jews. In its early years, Israel was uncomfortable with the legacy of the Shoah as an event in which millions allegedly went like sheep to the slaughter. That was the kind of education that I received in school. But starting with the trial of Adolf Eichmann in the early 1960s, and especially since the 1980s, when Israeli politics swung increasingly to the right, the Holocaust became a glue binding together the diverse and at times hostile sectors of the Jewish population in Israel. Over time, the genocide of the Jews came to play a growing role in Israeli life and rhetoric. That is, the greater the distance from the event, the the greater the impact of this memory of the Holocaust. So it came to play an increasing part in Israeli public life, in rhetoric, and the Holocaust was no longer perceived merely as a past event, but also as a future, indeed potentially imminent threat. This made for the creation of a collective mentality, both fragile and aggressive, created as a haven for Jews that would shield them from anti-Semitic violence. Israel began to perceive itself as always being threatened with extinction, even as its regional military superiority became increasingly unchallenged. This fear of another Auschwitz also provided license for disproportionate violence against anyone perceived as threatening the existence of the state. At the same time, the argument that during the Holocaust, the nations of the world had stood by rather than coming to the rescue of the Jews was employed to assert that when under threat, Israel had no obligation to accept any international norms, since its priority had to always remain focused on preserving its bare existence at any cost. Another crucial element in the transformation of Israeli society over time is the occupation of Palestinian territories in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip that followed the 1967 war.
You've been listening to Omar Bartov, recorded live at the U of O in April. KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio.
For most of its existence, 59 out of the 78 years that have passed since its establishment, Israel has controlled lands that lie outside the border lines established in the armistice of 1949 and contain large numbers of Palestinians. Taking in the full picture, 7 million Jewish Israeli citizens in effect now control 7 million Palestinians, of whom 2 million are Israeli citizens whose rights are restricted in myriad ways by the state, while 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and 2 million in the Gaza Strip have practically no rights at all. In the view of most Jewish Israeli citizens, those Palestinians do not even have the right to have rights. This ongoing occupation has had numerous effects on the country's politics, mentality, and norms. With time, the occupied Palestinians underwent social death as far as Jewish Israeli citizens were concerned, hidden behind a complex of separation walls, fences, bypass roads, and checkpoints. When Jewish citizens encounter occupied Palestinians, it is often as soldiers enforcing the occupation. In this role, their conduct is meant to show who is the boss, breaking into people's homes in the middle of the night, or humiliating Palestinians seeking to move across their lands or to get to their jobs, schools, or hospitals through endless checkpoints. The occupation has thus dehumanized the occupied and the occupiers alike. In his 1950 essay, Discourse on Colonialism, I'm sure some of you are familiar with that, the Martiniquais poet, author, and politician, Aimé Césaire, insightfully noted, and I'm quoting him, "Colonization works to decivilize the colonizer, to brutalize him in the true sense of the word, to degrade him, to awaken in him buried instincts, to covetousness, violence, race hatred, and moral relativism. A process whereby regression takes place, a gangrene sets in, a center of infection begins to spread, so that at the end of all these punitive expeditions that have been tolerated, all these prisoners who have been tied up and interrogated, all these patriots who have been tortured, at the end of all the racial pride that has been encouraged, all the boastfulness that has been displayed, a poison has been distilled into the veins of the country, and slowly but surely it proceeds toward savagery. So this is the process we've seen in Israel, most prominently with the settlement project, which has now brought some 750,000 Jews into the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, creating an apartheid regime whereby three-fourths of the population in these territories live under an arbitrary military legal system, most recently also with the introduction of the death penalty, and the remaining fourth enjoys all the rights and privileges of Jewish Israeli citizens, although they're extraterritorial. The October 7, 2023 attack by Hamas and the Israeli military operation in Gaza that followed, therefore cannot be understood without taking into account the larger historical context. The precise timing of the Hamas attack was likely precipitated by domestic disarray in Israel or the protest movements of the preceding months, and fears that the Palestinian issue was about to disappear completely from the international agenda. You may remember that the U.S. has run Saudi Arabia when negotiating over normalizing relations. But the deeper reason for the attack was the growing despair of the population in the Gaza Strip that had lived under an Israeli siege or blockade for the previous 16 years, whose livelihood, education, health, and prospects appeared increasingly dismal. Subsequently, the brutal Hamas attack deeply humiliated the IDF, instilled a sense of profound insecurity in the Israeli civilian population, and exposed the incompetence of the government. It also enraged a Jewish public that has grown used to thinking of Palestinians as a people who could easily be cowed into submission. And one should say that the Palestinian issue and the occupation were nowhere to be seen in previous election campaigns for quite a few years. The response was like that of other colonial systems when confronted by indigenous resistance, a desire to pulverize the rebels into submission and an assertion that the very savagery of the massacre proved the need to exterminate all the brutes, to quote Joseph Conrad's seminal Heart of Darkness about colonialism, the horrors of colonialism in Congo. If we are to make sense of the Israeli public's astonishing indifference to the massive death toll in Gaza, however critical many Israelis may be of their government and army, we must understand that when the former Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, called Hamas and by extension the rest of the population of Gaza human animals, he reflected sentiments held by a majority of the population. These sentiments flared after October 7th, but in point of fact were long prevalent among Jewish Israeli citizens as a result of the largely normalized occupation. To quote Cesare again, colonization dehumanizes even the most civilized man, since it is based on contempt for the native and justified by that contempt, so that the colonizer, who in order to ease his conscience, gets into the habit of seeing the other man as an animal, accustoms himself to treating him like an animal, and tends objectively to transform himself into an animal. This, as Césaire famously pointed out, is the boomerang effect of colonization, or le choc en retour in his original French. There should be little doubt that the Hamas attack, the massacre of hundreds of civilians, including children and the elderly, as well as reported cases of rape and other kinds of abuse, and the taking of hostages, is a war crime and a crime against humanity. It is also the case, however, that resisting oppression and dehumanization, including by force of arms, is not only understandable, but also legal under international law, especially when it forms part of a struggle for national self-determination. That's, of course, what the Jewish underground itself carried out in the years leading to 1948. We can condemn the barbarity of the attack, yet recognize the right to resist occupation, at least when it's directed at legitimate military targets. On July 19, 2024, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, ruled in its advisory opinion to the UN General Assembly that Israel's occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip was illegal. It said Israel has an obligation to bring an end to its presence in the occupied territory as rapidly as possible. But beyond such legal rulings, it should be recognized that resistance is also the most basic action of human self-assertion by the oppressed. As the former slave, orator, and social reformer Frederick Douglass movingly noted in his memoir, when describing his fight with a slave owner who tried to whip him, I quote, "This was the turning point in my life as a slave. It rekindled in my breast the smoldering embers of liberty and revived the sense of my own manhood. I was a changed being after that fight. I was nothing before. I was a man now." For its part, Israel has claimed a right of self-defense in its attack on Gaza. Israel was deeply traumatized by the massacre of October 7th. And its population generally agreed on the need to strike back as a means of self-defense. Indeed, the only legitimate war under international law is one of self-defense. Although given that Gaza is formally an occupied territory, that is not a fully satisfactory argument. But be that as it may, fighting a legal war does not legitimize severe breaches of international law, just as the right to resist does not legitimize the massacre of civilians. As it turns out, Israel's war was not merely an attempt to destroy Hamas and release the hostages, which the government pronounced to be its official goals, and both of which it failed to achieve by military means. In fact, from the very first day of its response to the Hamas attack, Israel acted in ways that hardly fit those goals. Because the far-right elements supporting Netanyahu and increasingly the Prime Minister himself actually viewed October 7th, after they recovered from the shock, as an opportunity to eliminate the Palestinian issue in Gaza altogether, under the guise of self-defense. Thus, Israeli officials declared an intention which the government set about implementing to systematically destroy Gaza. In line with numerous statements by politicians and military officers with executive authority, which threatened to flatten Gaza, to deprive its population, among whom it was said there were no uninvolved people, of food and water, the IDF also set about demolishing the vast majority of the educational, cultural, and health facilities in Gaza. This clearly demonstrated its goal not only of destroying Hamas and its capacity to govern, but also of making the entire area uninhabitable and depriving the population of everything that makes for group identity and continuity. In other words, Ezra declared his intention and then engaged in an attempt to destroy the Palestinian people living in the Gaza Strip in whole or in part as such, thereby reaching the high bar of the Genocide Convention. Now, as was mentioned, I actually reached this conclusion after considerable deliberation between October 2023 and May 2024. And I wrote originally about that in August of 24. This was then reiterated in July of 25. Much more proof since then has accumulated. Following the IDF's ethnic cleansing operations in northern Gaza beginning in October 2024, as well as after Israel broke the ceasefire in March 2025, imposing, you may remember, a total halt on humanitarian aid and emptying vast areas of the Gaza Strip of the civilian population. Disturbingly, this genocidal operation was carried out with almost complete impunity and has thus also threatened the continued existence, or at least relevance, of the entire international legal edifice that was put into place after World War II. The country most responsible for allowing the continuation of this undertaking was and remains the United States, without whose constant military and political support, the fighting would have ended much sooner. In fact, it could have ended in November or December 2023, in which case we might have said the genocide had almost happened, but was stopped. And this was under the Biden administration, of course. The United States could have worked toward a deal that would have enabled the return of the hostages, the removal of the Hamas leadership from Gaza, the installation of a different Palestinian authority in the territory, and the launching of a political process geared toward resolving the conflict through negotiations rather than violence. But the current Israeli government is adamantly opposed to any political settlement with the Palestinians. I should say that when we look now at Israel's engagement in Lebanon, in Iran, in Syria, in Gaza, in the West Bank, all these engagements have to do first and foremost with the issue of the Palestinians. That is the core issue. Until October 7th, Netanyahu preferred having Hamas rule over Gaza as proof that there was no viable political option. Indeed, as early as October 2015, Bezalel Smotrich, now Netanyahu's powerful finance minister, referred to Hamas as an asset, invoking precisely the same logic that induced Netanyahu to allow millions of dollars to be delivered via Israel from Qatar to Hamas. So as we observe the current situation on the ground, we need to ask ourselves what the possible future scenarios for this devastated region might be, and what implications they will have for the nature of the state of Israel. Will the country persist on the course it is on at the moment, compounding all that has gone wrong with Israeli politics and society in an irreversible plunge into the abyss of authoritarianism, violence, and oppression? Or will it radically change course and set about the long process of repair, reconciliation, and achieving long-delayed but urgently needed justice? I can envision two scenarios. The first is that Israel will persist in its attempt to empty Gaza of its Palestinian population, or, as seems more likely, to subject it to ever more inhumane conditions in the wasteland of what had once been its home. Right-wing pressures to annex parts of Gaza and the West Bank, de facto, if not de jure, may bring about the eventual creation of an even stricter apartheid regime in all or much of the occupied territories. this system will inevitably seep into Israel proper, as it is actually happening right now, first targeting Palestinian citizens and rendering their citizenship increasingly meaningless, and then also turning against any Jewish citizens who oppose it or fail to conform to its regressive, unjust, and undemocratic norms. As the regime becomes more and more authoritarian, its legal establishment weakens and adapts, and violence becomes ever more prevalent, Israel will grow isolated and less affluent, a pariah state. The Jewish communities around the world will be embarrassed to be associated with, even if they will likely face a growing tide of anti-Semitism. Members of the liberal professions and persuasions will leave, and many of Israel's allies will distance themselves from it, as its claim to be the only democracy in the Middle East will be shown to be nothing more than a farce. This condition could last for a few decades, but it eventually is likely to lead to the state's implosion, as transpired in South Africa. But by then, much blood will have been shed and much suffering endured, and the civil rights struggle that will follow might be just as bloody. The second, more optimistic, but less likely scenario is that Israel and the Palestinians will be compelled to change the entire political paradigm under which they have been living since 1948. Among outside actors, only the United States is in a position to use the current tragedy as an opportunity to seek a political solution for the 14 million Jews and Palestinians living between the river and the sea. Such a solution would enable them to share the land within whichever political framework they choose, a bi-national state, two states, or a confederation, ensuring equality, justice, and dignity for all. Some opinion polls suggest that even today, this is what most people in Israel and Palestine prefer, but they will support such an option only when it is realistic and presented by a reliable, steadfast political leadership. The desire for peace on its own is no recipe for diffusing the fear and rage on both sides. A political solution is also what most Sunni Arab states in the region support, but it can happen only under firm and determined American leadership. Whether the current administration can remain focused on its peace plan and translate it into a long-term concrete steps is doubtful. Nonetheless, and here I close, all those who care about Israel and Palestine, as I do, must work toward the second scenario, by whichever means are at their disposal. As a historian, I believe that the first step to building a better future is understanding the hopes and aspirations, as well as the errors and sins of the past. It is for this reason that I wrote this book. My goal is neither to praise Zionism and the state it created, nor to condemn it. There are many good, thoughtful, creative, and deeply humane people in that land, Jews and Palestinians, who hope for and deserve a different reality from the one they are currently subjected to. The blanket condemnation or dismissal that fills the air these days does not reflect this far more complex reality. I can only hope that what I wrote and other people have been writing will contribute to an opening of minds, that in its own small way, it may help reverse the tide of hatred and destruction by allowing us all to understand how we got there in the first place, and perhaps also how we might clamber out of the abyss. Thank you.